You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
8 minutes after 11. Thank you so much for staying with us. It is the third and final hour of the show. And my goodness, what a fabulous middle hour that was. I see all of your requests for the podcast. Don't worry, Danae is onto it. And once we have it, we will, of course, tweet it. I'll put it on my Facebook page. But as always, just regularly check on our website, 702.co.za, and all the podcasts are archived there if you missed any part of the show. So thank you so much to my last two guests, to Marcosini and also to Rams, for their insights into government communications and strategically managing a crisis and not letting a crisis go to waste. And I think that was a really beautiful and practical conversation. Moving on to more hateful stuff. John Kwelane, remember him? Well, he got promoted for his homophobia. You will remember many years ago in 2008 in the Sunday Sun, a column titled "Call Me Names, But Gay Is Not Okay." That part is not the bit that is unconstitutional and wrong. It is the incredible homophobia and the content thereafter that he obviously, peddled that has landed him in trouble. And it's amazing because that happened in 2008. We're now in 2017. And this thing is still making its way through the courts, which I've just almost forgotten, in fact. And one of my guests reminded me, rightly so, to actually draw attention to this issue. And I think we all needed to. And I haven't even thought about John Kwelane. I think when things are so busy in the news cycle, there are often important issues that bubble under that we forget to keep tabs on. So I want to talk a little bit about the hate speech case. If you have a question for any of my guests, I'll introduce them in a second. You can call us on 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg. And our Cape Town number is 021-446-0567. But really, there are two sets of framing questions for the next half an hour. The first is just, why is the law important around issues of hate speech? And then secondly, given that the law is also a blunt instrument, how else are we going to deal with hatred in society? And I'm joined in the studio by Kerry Williams, who's a partner at Webber Wentzel, representing the Psychological Society of South Africa as a friend of the court in this case. Kerry, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks very much, Jacibus.
And also Melanie Judge, I almost said, who's been a lifelong queer activist, but maybe she was born queer. She's been an activist for a large part of her life. Melanie, thank you so much for coming in.
Great to be here.
I really do appreciate you being here. I want to start firstly with you, Kerry. For those who might have forgotten or somehow not been aware of this case, what is this case about? What exactly is going on at the moment? Where are we at?
Yeah, it's so actually simple. We're in an equality court, the Johannesburg High Court, and there are two matters that are actually being heard at the same time. The one is a straightforward equality court trial, and the other is a constitutional challenge to the Equality Act. And the trial, as you mentioned at the beginning, is because of John Kwelane's words in that article. And the South African Human Rights Commission has taken him to court, and they're running the trial. We've come in as friends of the court. And it starts off with leading evidence, and later in the week, we're going to hear the constitutional challenge.
What did he say in this column that landed him in legal trouble?
Well, he did a lot of very nuanced, hateful things, in fact. As you say, the headline isn't the thing that's particularly hateful, but it's the content. And there are many things that are egregious about it. One is comparing gay people to, or LGBTI folk to, animals. And he did that by supporting Robert Mugabe's view on gay people. And he also, I suppose, did that by... the article was published with a cartoon which represented... he compared gay people getting married to marrying an animal, which suggests that the association with bestiality, I suppose, is the best way to put it. But it's very subtle. But as soon as you start invoking animal metaphors in relation to people, then you get into very damaging space and hateful speech.
I've seen many people over the years debating whether the legislation that obviously prohibits that kind of hatred is constitutionally above board. And it seemed to me at one point, I got bored because the court case has been dragging out for so long. So I've even lost my sense of the thread of where the legalese is at, which I want to come back to in a second, because I think there's a point there too about the legal system. Mm-hmm. But Kerry, I mean, even, prominent gay scholars like Professor Pierre de Vos who obviously cares deeply about justice for gay people, when wearing his constitutional hat, has often drawn attention to some reasonable disagreement that constitutional scholars can have about specific pieces of legislation. So we can share the aim of eliminating hate speech. And it sounded to me at one point as if Kwelane's team wanted to almost shift the goalposts from the homophobia to this meta-analysis about the law.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what the constitutional challenge is about. It's an attempt to focus the case on freedom of expression. But our client's view and my view is that this is a case not about freedom of expression. It's about equality. It's about dignity. It's about psychological integrity and bodily integrity. And look, the reason I say that is, and I'll come back to Pierre's arguments, if you like, if that's helpful. But the reason I say it is what we're trying to do in this case is we're introducing evidence on the impact of the hate speech. So the impact of the hate speech on the LGBTI community, on gay people themselves, the psychological impact, and also then the harmful effects it has on society. So we're saying, look, in this constitutional project that we are supposedly all part of and started in kind of 1994, 96, we think the Equality Act is meant to be used to in innovative ways and to bring some kind of justice. And we're saying this is exactly the act that's going to bring your speaker of the hate speech, you might call that the perpetrator, and your victim, or I don't like that language, but it's hard to find a substitute, together, and actually have a dialogue and say, look, this is how the speech caused harm. This is how the speech caused damage. And the perpetrator then gets to see that this is not speech that happens in a vacuum.
Okay. In your understanding, or in your interpretation, and in very plain language, what are the elements that have to be proven for someone to have violated the law?
There has to be some form of utterance. And it has to be either hurtful, harmful, or propagate hatred. And that's an or. So hurtful, harmful, or propagate hatred. And we very purposefully say that's an or because hurt does count in this context. Some have tried to make the argument that only speech that can be prohibited is speech which, let's say, causes physical harm. Mm. That's absolutely not the case in South Africa. And I suppose that's why I started with this kind of equality project. What are we trying to do here? Are we trying to only prohibit speech that causes physical harm and stops me bashing you over the head or you bashing me over the head? I don't think so. We're trying to...
In law, not in social reality.
Yeah. The law... there's a...
One would hope. But you know how law and justice sometimes come apart, Kerry.
Sure. In law,
how does one test for and prove, and as a judicial officer in court, adjudicate hurtfulness? Because if Melanie says to me, "You fag," and I go, "Oh, I'm hurt, guilty," right? We can recognize that she did something wrong socially, ethically, and we can talk about how we're going to deal with it in a second. And that's why I've got Melanie here for that leg of the conversation in particular. But in the first instance, from a legal point of view, you don't want the legislation to be so wide that someone can fall foul of that depending on what a magistrate or judge had for breakfast.
No, absolutely. So when we speak about hurt and when we defend that component of the act, that's we are talking about a serious form of hurt. And the way we're proving that is in this case, we have an expert evidence, Jean Null, who's a psychologist, and he is actually showing what the impact of this form of speech has on individuals, both through his own psychological practice and through his research on victimology. So it's not everyday hurt, so to speak, as in, you know, I feel hurt by what you said, or I feel offended by what you said. There has to be a form of resilience.
So there's nothing wrong with the law as far as you're concerned.
Nothing wrong with
the courts are perfectly capable of reasonably, on the evidence, deciding whether that criterion had been met or not. And those wanting to debate whether the legal language is consistent with the Constitution or not are simply obfuscating the issues.
Well, I wouldn't be... I suppose, rude about them and say obfuscating, but I would say what they're not considering is...
Lawyers are so polite.
Look, what I think that's been missing from the debate is, and would you like me to get technical?
No, I do, and I tell you why, because what's been fascinating to me, including the piece that you guys wrote jointly, is how many people that I deeply respect who have a deep commitment to social justice are worried about poorly drafted pieces of legislation.
Yeah. Okay, so to get technical about it, The legislation is quite wordy, but there's a constitutional obligation to interpret legislation in line with the Constitution, which you certainly can do in this case.
Okay.
You take out
makes
the ambiguity.
Sense.
So that manages the vagueness.
That makes sense, yeah.
As soon as you've managed the vagueness, which is a very simple exercise and firmly entrenched in our jurisprudence, then you go to the constitutional right to freedom of expression. And you say, look, what does it say? it's got an inbuilt limitation. It doesn't extend to, let's say, certain forms of genocide or hate speech. You could say, okay, hurt doesn't fit into that. We're not there yet. But what the Constitution also does is it allows for limitation of all rights. And we're saying it's justifiable to limit the right to freedom of expression in relation to this form of psychological hurt and harm, which has this impact.
I should tell the listeners just an interesting side note about production processes. So when we decided we want to actually focus on this issue this morning, and obviously, you know, you go to Melanie. And I'm like, no, all you need is Kerry. And I've never met Kerry before. I can totally see why. She's like, no, dude, all you need is Kerry and your student. You're just so brilliant. But the question I want to ask, Melanie, because you're obviously brilliant in your own right, is that, and I can see you nodding there, the bottom line is you and I and Kerry want to live in a world in which we do not have to try and use the law to get John Kwalani to respect our dignity and our substantive equality. Is the law, although useful, ultimately an adversarial and blunt instrument?
Thanks. I told you, Kerry would say.
You told me.
But
you're right.
But now the pressure's on to say something in addition. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this issue of blunt instrument, you know, and I was sort of struck at the reality, just to take the metaphor a bit further, that thousands of people the world over die as a result of blunt instruments every day. And in some cases, that blunt instrument is the law. So if you look at the ways in which homosexuality has been criminalized in some parts of the world, you see how the law does the work of prejudice and it does the work of dehumanization. What we're trying to do here, and I think many LGBT activists have been doing this in the post-apartheid period very successfully, is however much we tussle with the law and its failings in many ways, it remains a very, very powerful instrument to shift social relations. Absolutely, we would want, you know, we would welcome John Kwalani actually standing up and taking responsibility, accounting to LGBT people in a social forum and saying, I've hurt and I've harmed and I therefore unequivocally apologize. But until we create a social environment in which people do that willingly, we have to, in a sense, use stealth. We have to use the instruments that are available to us to hold people to account, in particular when we're seeing such pernicious forms of dehumanization. Mm. That, for me, is part of our history. Mm. So these laws haven't emerged in a vacuum. You know, part of the Equality Act is about processes of civil redress, which is really about trying to reorganize the social relationships so that we deal with issues of racism, xenophobia, sexism in much more constructive ways. And laws like the Equality Act can help us do that without kind of throwing people into prison.
I like that, and I think that's beautiful and important. You know, it's so easy to be disillusioned by the gap between constitutional vision and reality that we can end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater because we are frustrated that the constitutional text was not a magic wand in 1994, Kerry. But you know, when I listen to what Melanie's saying, it reminds me of what Justice Edwin Cameron has said. While recognizing that in our communities we need to deal with hatred and homophobia, do not underestimate the social function of the law and something as simple as the law saying the state hereby deems you to be an equal citizen.
And just on that note, because I think there's a sort of a fiction that the law is something that middle-class people use to defend their rights and it's not accessible to your average, let's say, LGBT person, the majority of whom would be black. Now, I think it's a fiction for two reasons. One, because, yes, you know, laws and courts are very often inaccessible. But when people assert their rights in their communities, in their synagogues, in their churches, what do they often say? They say, I'm allowed to be here because of the Constitution. I'm allowed to be here because I'm invoking the right to equality and to dignity. People, so the law is also a language. Mm. It's not only an instrument, a technical legal instrument.
Kerry, I want to bring you in there. It's important, isn't it, to not be glib about what the law can achieve just because we can rattle off its limitations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is hugely important to the work that we're doing in this case and the work that I do more generally. I think we've underutilized the Equality Act and, in a way, forget to read it again and again to see what it has to offer. And I just want to focus on that. It's an act which is designed to be procedurally simple. You can go to a magistrate's court or a high court. Anyone can go. You can take evidence in different ways. There doesn't have to be a full-blown trial. There doesn't have to be an affidavit. I've run equality court matters which are over in a couple of days and in court within a couple of weeks. And that's the point. It's bringing people together. So it's this restorative tool or mechanism that allows for this. And it was drafted in the age of hope, you know, in the mid-90s. Mm. And that hope is, there's something about that hope that's been lost in this context. And as a result, people forget to use it, is my sense. So really, it's almost like, I mean, we've used the analogy, it's an ongoing TRC because it allows one to come and process pain, express pain, you know, and many other things as well. It's also remedially very flexible. Mm. So it's not like we're asking for a lot.
Absolutely. Human Rights Commission. Can we focus a little bit on that psychological evidence that your client will be presenting? And I want both of you here to enter the conversation. Some people do make a distinction between physical harm or imminent physical harm on the one hand, and then what they may say is mere speech on the other. And you flagged at the outset in our dialogue that there's no such thing as mere speech. Some words can have an actual effect on someone's well-being. What is that connection?
So the evidence that Jean will be leading, and we've set this out kind of in the papers, and in a way it's, I mean, watch the case, because I can't say exactly what he'll say. He's still to lead it. But what we've flagged is certainly the effects on the individual. So let's say LGBTI folk who spend their life actually being the subjects of hate speech will experience greater forms of depression, suicidal ideation. It has an impact on their psychological makeup and their ability to participate in society. That also has a, let's say, a ripple effect on the LGBTI community. If I watch you being the subject of hate speech or you watch me, I immediately think, well, I'm at risk here. You know, if you see CBS as being kind of verbally abused, I should retreat in terms of, you know, not putting myself out as, you know, gay in the public. So that has an effect on the LGBTI community. And then again, it has the effect on everyone because we're not creating a society which is productive. You know, we're spending time kind of abusing each other. So it has a negative effect on society.
No, I get that, right, yeah. So but in a sense, what I wanted to do, and I mean, you did in the first part, and Melanie, please come in here, is so people can have an understanding why the harm is tangible. Right. We have, to put it simply and bluntly, we have this weird idea in society that I haven't harmed Melanie unless she has a black eye.
Or a sticks and stones type argument.
So I think one of the critical issues when thinking about what the effect of speech is to recognize two things. One, speech is never uttered in a vacuum. It's uttered in a very particular context. And the other thing is that not all speech has the same level of power. And so where it's significant is if you have an ongoing narrative in society that is acceptable to speak to queer people or black people in dehumanizing ways, it legitimizes their treatment in a way that undermines dignity. And ultimately, if you look at, you know, if you look at a continuum, let's say you take genocide on the one hand, whether you take the Holocaust or whether you take Rwanda, and you look at the kinds of utterances that were made normalized, Jews as rats or cockroaches in Rwanda, that kind of speech can actually create the conditions that make more pernicious and direct forms of violence possible. And in a country like ours, we know what that looks like. We know the relationship between dehumanizing, harmful and hurtful speech and direct violence, subjugation, inferiorization of black people, of women, of black women in particular. So we deep sense of the connections between what we say and, in a sense, people's experiences of, or non-experiences of being treated like full humans.
So, okay, so there's a genuine link. There may not be, in legal speak, Kerry, approximate cause, but if I understand Melanie correctly, and I assume this is what your expert witness will get at, that there is a genuine, real-life, ultimate link between these kinds of words and phrases and speech acts and the very real possibility of, say, for example, a lesbian woman being raped because she's lesbian.
I think that's a social fact. I think you're right, that argument can be made, but it's actually not the argument that we are going to make in this case.
So it's not instrumental, it's harmful in itself.
Absolutely. There's psychological harm.
Okay.
So that's why I suppose I focused on the actual psychology of it. So and that's it's an important distinction to make because it what justifies prohibiting speech that's hurtful. And sure, it's not as, let's say, harmful as a genocide, of course, or physical violence, but it has a quantifiable harm.
Okay. So both is probably true, right?
Yes.
Even though they're difficult. So your psychological integrity is undermined, and in addition to that, there's a very real risk that you are ripening the atmosphere for other forms of harm, including physical harm. Let's take one call before we wrap up. Can you guys just put on your headphones if you have any there in front of you? Citizen Nina. Hello, Nina.
Hi, you CBS. Love what you do all the time. You CBS, the question that I have, and it's something I've been meditating on for quite a while, is what happens, of course, to women's rights for equality? As far as I'm concerned, the statement, son of a bitch, actually undermines women and is psychologically and potentially physically hurtful. And the results of these kind of terminologies mean the levels of rape in this country. So it's contextually relevant.
Beautiful question, Nina. Right to the point. My guests instantly get you. I can see from their faces. I'm going to give you guys about 45 seconds each. And Kerry is pointing, nodding towards Melanie to answer there. Nina's absolutely right, right? It's a beautiful example. And it's also one jurisprudentially that brings up the complications. Because I think a lawyer on the other side might then ask, where do we stop with these examples? Let's start with you, Melanie.
I'm going to leave the legalese response to Kerry, but I think, you know, the call has raised a very important issue, and that goes back to the ways in which we've underutilized the Equality Act. And we have not seen enough cases around gender-based violence, violence against women in particular, and the use of sexist and misogynist language. So, without offering an opinion on that specific phraseology, I think we need to bring it on. I think we've got a far too high level of tolerance for violent language against women in our country. And I think you certainly are seeing those conditions, in a sense, supporting the continued scourge of the violences that we face.
Kerry, you have the final say.
Yeah, look, very good question, and in a way very difficult to answer, because it's much easier to run strategic cases, I suppose, around homophobia or racism. Gender patriarchy brings in its own level of complexity. But I think much would depend on the context of the use of the phrase, and you'd have to think very carefully about how to position it, who's saying it, who's being said to, and then, of course, you'd actually have to show the hurt. But it's the same with everything. You always have to look at context and understand where these utterances are taking place and why, who they're being directed at.
I could listen to you guys the whole day. Such brilliance. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And all the best with this case.